Welcome everyone to episode 32 of the Greater European Talks. And today we have a very special guest today. We have the Rector of the College of Europe, Federica Mogherini. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Philip.
So the reason we wanted to bring the Rector, although we could talk about any number of issues, and we would love to do so in future podcasts, but today I want to talk a little bit about making the EU a global actor. Ms. Mogherini was, of course, elected as a deputy for the Veneto region 2008-2014, and following that, she was nominated the foreign minister for the Italian Republic, and then became the HRVP, the High Representative for Foreign and Security Affairs of the Union and Vice President of the Commission from 2014 to 2019. And since then, has been the Rector for College Europe since September 2020, and as I found out recently, the co-chair of the UN panel on international displacement with Donald Caberucca. Has that been an active position, I wanted to ask?
Yes, I had a 4 hour meeting of the panel yesterday because we're finalizing the report. We're going to hand it in to the Secretary General Guterres in September, hopefully in New York.
Fantastic. A little bit of a tangent, but I always find it's very interesting to sort of to look at the multitude of actions that we have. And so, of course, as HRVP, one of the defining moments was the publishing of the EU Global Strategy in June 2016. Now, a little bit of history for our listeners here. In 2003, there was the Europe Security Strategy, which essentially was the first strategy that the EU helped to lay out some of its security ideas and its direction. Since then, in June 2015, I believe the European Council mandated yourself as HRVP to create this global strategy, and then in a year managed to publish it. And then every year after that, there was this sort of implementation follow-up. And then in 2019, the sort of roundup, the 2019, 3 years on from vision to action. Now, the 2016 document was shared vision, common action, a stronger Europe. My first question I want to ask is if we can cast our minds back to June 2015, you'd be mandated to make this global strategy. Where do you start? Where was it for you and how was it for you to realize, well, I have to do something that no one's done in 12 years with a wide range of things having changed since 2003?
You know, actually, a little bit of behind the scenes. Actually, I asked that mandate to the Council informally. So sometimes the High Representative is mandated by the Council, the European Council, in different formations to do something because it is an initiative of the Council. Some other times, it's the High Representative himself or herself that somehow stimulates the decision. And in this case, it was my choice to post to the Council to have a new strategy. Even more behind the scene, behind the scenes, the very first, one of the very first visits I did when I learned that I was nominated High Representative, that was still end of August 2014, I visited Madrid and I went to talk to Javier Solana, that was my mentor somehow, and I asked him advice, obviously, and one of the things he told me, among many others, good advices that I followed, was Federica, you should look at the strategy because, you know, the world has changed in 2003. It was a great document, but it's simply not up to date. And so I started actually, even before starting my mandate, to think of that. We built a process. The process was somehow even more important than the outcome of the document. And we started indeed early 2015 to set up a framework, who to involve, academia, national stakeholders, international partners. I remember we received inputs from Japan or Canada or South Africa. It was great to ask stakeholders both inside and outside of the Union, what should we do? What do you expect from the European Union on the global scene? What do you believe could be the triggers to do it properly? And it was, the mandate from the Council was not coming as a surprise. We had already somehow set the stage for doing that. But then from June 2015 to June 2016 was a lot of hard work, a lot of people involved. And it was really a collective effort, collective endeavor. And I think that is why the document at the end was good, because it was really the result of a multitude of meetings and ongoing drafting. And it was really an excellent procedural exercise, not only in terms of content. And this is why I believe it is still valid today. Somehow it has been reconfirmed as a valid framework, strategic framework for the Union, even if in 5 years many things have changed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of leads to another question, which is why, in your opinion, was it important to have a new global strategy? Of course, it's quite obvious to think, well, there's the Treaty of Lisbon, which changed things, the financial crisis. In your opinion, as HRVP then, and maybe even thinking back on the successes of the global strategy, why did we need it?
Two reasons, I would say. One came after the global strategy was presented, or just together with that. But the main reason, I would say, was that I had the feeling that indeed we were lacking an updated strategy document, and I believe that every entity, any political player, institutional player that wants to play a global role has to have a common strategic vision. Let's put it this way. And definitely, we didn't have that, because 2003, everything was rosy the world was looking a nice cooperative place. In 2015-16 was definitely far from that. So we needed a common analysis of where we stood, but also mainly, for me, it was important to have a common understanding of what we wanted to do as a global player. After the Lisbon Treaty, there were many instruments that were not used. Mm-hmm. And I kept hearing and listening to the arguments that they were not used and they would have never been used because of lack of political will. Mm-hmm. And then I said, okay, let's test this political will, because, you know, if you don't ask the question, you would never get the answer. And so the question was, do we want to use all the instruments we have? That was the main underlying issue. And the answer was yes. Many were still warning me, it's a courtesy answer, don't believe that. And then we tested it further and we tried to implement it. And that's why the implementation reports were so important, because we were somehow measuring how much of a consistency was there from different institutional players inside the European Union Council, Commission, and states, the defense community. And indeed, for instance, on defense, we used the instruments that were there in the treaty, but they were somehow dormant. And they were not really used. So that was the main reason, to have a strategic common vision and to ask the question, do we want to use the instruments we have? If yes, how to do it? So it was also a roadmap for operational decisions to be taken, and that was done. So I was very satisfied with that. Then there was a side element to this, because you have noticed for sure that the strategy was presented at the European Council in June 2016, that was also the European Council when the Brexit referendum was dominating element. That was happening only a few days before. You might remember better than me the exact day.
I believe June 23rd.
That's it. So it was just 3 days, I think, 2 or 3 days before, not even. And at that moment, we had a lot of talks about postponing the presentation, because obviously the scene would have been hijacked by that. And I thought, actually, it's exactly the moment of and we say troubles or crisis or turmoil, that you need to reaffirm externally that you are there. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was even more important to affirm that the Union was united and determined to play a global role in the moment when everybody was looking at us and asking if that was the beginning of the end. And to say, not only is not the beginning of the end, but we are determined to play a major role worldwide, with or without UK. Mm-hmm. And I was super happy to see that actually not only the endorsement of the strategy, but also the implementation of the strategy continued till the end of my mandate, end of 2019, with the full participation of the UK in all sectors. Never once, neither on foreign security defense policies, we had a problem with the UK on implementation of the global strategy, because there was full ownership also on the UK side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you allude to a very important point there as well, which is sort of member states. So in the implementation document, you sort of allude to the fact that, well, for the implementation of the trust strategy, member states have been involved fully. Do you think you were successful? You alluded to Brexit, but successful involving member states in the actual usage of the global strategy? Because member states have their own global strategies. That's one thing that we can't forget. Each did publish their own sort of various documents. What role did member states have in the implementation of the strategy, and do you think it was successful?
They played a major role in shaping the strategy in the first place. Well, first of all, because they mandated the High Representative to do it. So it was somehow a joint endeavor. It was a joint task, because once the Council mandates the High Representative to do something, somehow they share the responsibility of delivering something good. And so that was starting point. Then there was this huge participatory process before 2016. So member states at all levels, parliaments, different ministries, including in some cases presidents or prime ministers or chancellery offices, but also academia, think tanks, NGOs. There was really a large consultation process. So most member states, all member states had a chance to do their own bit. All member states had full vision of what was coming up before it was finalized.
Mm-hmm.
In different forms, we developed smart ways of consulting without introducing any veto mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very, very interesting procedure. But all of them could recognize their inputs in the strategy. And so all of them felt the ownership and responsibility for implementation. Some more on some issues, some more on other issues, all of them felt that that was their strategy as well. So mm-hmm. I was very happy with that. And this is why they actually took a relevant part in the implementation. I mentioned the work we did on the implementation of defense part of it. That wouldn't have been possible without member states, because defense competences are on the council side. Only the industrial and research part is on the commission side. But without the member states, we wouldn't have implemented the decisions on the structure cooperation,
yeah.
all the work we've done on defense budgets, coordination, work with the European Defense Agency. The work with NATO
mm-hmm.
was fundamentally done together with member states, and most of all those that are members of the alliance and member states. Even though one of the key moments for me was when we discussed with Stoltenberg the defense part of the European Union strategy in Malta, and that was the first time he was visiting. And I think a NATO Secretary General was visiting the island, because Malta was having the presidency. So I think there was a good ownership and a good sense of responsibility also on the implementation side of all member states, none excluded.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, of course, whilst you mentioned you want to avoid a veto, of course, one of the reasons potentially is because you discuss an item that would be particularly difficult for a member state. Let's say you discussed Turkey in the document and Cyprus was not happy with it. Were you ever worried at some point that a member state might try and rip up parts of the strategy?
No. It's true, the strategy was not voted
yeah.
in the European Council. It was endorsed. But that was also, I think, what happened with the 2003 security strategy. And that, I think, was the right institutional way to proceed. So we didn't avoid the vote to avoid a veto. We actually chose to have a lighter version of endorsement because it was somehow political. The adoption of conclusions or decisions normally has institutional consequences. That was not a formal document of the Council to be adopted. It was a political document to be endorsed. So the choice to endorse it and not to adopt it formally as a Council document was more related to the nature of the document, and also the fact that we wanted to keep it open to potential changes in the future. We wanted mm-hmm. to be able to review it if needed without going through the Council decision again. So we wanted to keep it as a working document, which was then not necessarily done. But no, I was never afraid or scared about veto temptations. And I have to say, all member states were happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
They were all, probably many of them, or some of them, let's put it this way, some of them might have been unhappy with some parts of it.
Yeah.
But overall, they were all happy with the entire document. The method that we adopted was an interesting one that I followed also for many other decisions that were taken actually by unanimity with a formal vote. And that is that rather than, sometimes you think that to achieve consensus, you have to take out parts of the document. And actually, sometimes the contrary is true. If you add things, you allow everyone to recognize their own bit in the document and go back home saying, mm-hmm. okay, we're not happy with that, but that is in. And so it's worth it. And somehow the global strategy was done this way, avoiding the veto temptation by making sure that everybody could recognize some parts of the document as fully theirs. And in overall terms, the entire reflection as being a common one. And it was indeed probably one of the most difficult discussions were indeed about strategic economy and defense. But But then it was also the part that was most successfully implemented.
Of course, yes. People forget actually the strategic autonomy was already kind of defined and involved in the global strategy. Yes. So we've talked a little bit about the mandate, a little bit about the creation, a little bit about the implementation. I want to kind of start, have the big open question here. Did the global strategy help Europe become a global actor?
Yes. If you ask me if this is enough or sufficient, obviously not. But it helped for sure. It helped because it gave a solid basis, a common solid basis for action and not only for policy definition. It gave us somehow a roadmap of priorities to work on in times where, and this was intentional, in times when, if you remember, go back 2015, 2016, the feeling back then was that we were surrounded by crisis and emergencies.
Ring of fire.
Exactly. And the feeling was that we had to deal with what was urgent, which was true, but then you risk skipping what is important but not urgent. There might be things that are not the headline of the day. I'm not Syria, I'm not Libya, I'm not refugee crisis, I'm not Ukraine, Russia, but are important for your global stand. Easy partnerships, investment in friendships, investment in long-term projects that maybe do not pay off week after, but they are important to be built because after 10, 20, 30 years, they're going to constitute the bulk of your stand on the global scene. And you can do that only if you have a strategic instrument to guide you there. That tells you, apart from the headline of the day on which you have to react and on which you have to work, you also have an underlying work that needs to be done. Defense was exactly that. Mm-hmm. But also, for instance, partnership with Africa or Latin America was part of that. So it helped because it helped us building the, I would say, the foundations of the credibility actor in, in the external role, in the external relation of European. And also, it helped on a very practical side, which is the coordination that was not really existing before or not efficiently, let's put it this way, among different services in the institutions. You have the Council, you have the Commission, you have the External Action Service, you have the European Defence Agency, you have the European Parliament. Then you had the High Representative coordinating all of that, obviously, but without a structured way of doing that. And the global strategy was clearly indicating in the last part, one of the most precious parts, less exciting probably, but most precious parts in terms of instruments, how to have what we called a joined-up approach to the external action of European Union. And that was instrumental to be a player in the world. Mm-hmm. Again, did it solve everything and anything? Far from that. But without that, I think we would have had much more difficulties in playing our role in the world, especially in times when it was needed.
Yes, that's very true. You already said my next question, in fact. But that is, so what's left or what was missing, in your opinion, from that strategy document that can be addressed through global strategy, that is? Because maybe it's we have this tendency in IR studies, at least for myself, that we think these global strategies are going to solve everything. They may not. But what do you wish there was more of in the global strategy that would have helped? Or was there anything left on the cutting room floor, despite your best attempts?
No, I would say when we presented it, and even today, I was perfectly happy with that. And I didn't see any missing part. And for sure, there was no part that we left out and that could have been there. No, it's true that there were some things that were hinted at in the strategy and only hinted at, and then developed in the implementation much more than it was foreseen in the global strategy. On defense, for instance, we've done much more than it was written in the strategy, but everything we've done had its roots and legitimacy in the global strategy. So there were things that were not explicitly developed as much as they were in the implementation, also because we wanted to test how it went. I would say now, today, obviously, the part on, probably the part on relations with China might need an update or at least a little bit more closer look. because relations with China have developed enormously in different ways, let's put it this way, from 2015-16 to now. And obviously, the part on global health that I think was mentioned but not developed
at
the moment. It was mentioned, I think, together with the climate change and environmental and in general terms sustainability element. But I think that obviously that might be an element to be explored much more.
I don't believe you could have predicted the pandemic. If you did, I would have been more concerned, I believe, than anything.
No, we didn't. We didn't, but there was not much to predict, actually, because indeed we had in 2014 the Ebola crisis.
Yep, true.
That was not that limited, on the contrary. So, and Europe helped quite a lot in that respect. So actually, if I'm not wrong, in the global strategy, there is a reference to pandemics and the need to be a player also on that part of the global landscape. But obviously, it was not as developed as it would be now. But it was indeed already clearly included in the strategic thinking of the Union, including in terms of support to the multilateral system and the UN agencies and the need to have some effective forms of global governance, including the work on global health.
If I was to look at another major strategy document, so sort of defines EU's global action, I would probably go to its trade strategy document, which it kind of updates every 10 years, not necessarily on the dot, but it usually does so with various interludes in between. Do you believe that the EU's global strategy should be updated at a similar time frame, that it should be more institutionalized, or that it remains more of a flexible strategy as it is now?
I think it really depends a lot on the developments on the global scene. I think that you might see times of relative continuity in the world dynamics, where obviously situations and crises change, but the overall trends are fundamentally the same. And you might have shockwaves that determine a completely different strategic scenario, and then you have to definitely go for it. So I think that for the global strategy, what is important is to have the flexibility to be reviewed at any moment. I don't think that having a calendar for a foreseen review on, I don't know, 5 years or 10 years or 15 years basis would serve the purpose, simply because you can have 10 years in which the strategy is still valid, or you can have 2 years in which it is not anymore. And we've seen the volatility and the unpredictability of global trends these years. Strangely enough, I have to say, the global strategy has been adopted and worked on in 2016, so at the edge of major global changes, Brexit, the Trump administration, then the pandemic, the shift in the Chinese position in the world. And yet, the major strategic guidelines are valid, and most of all, the action plan somehow is still valid, because it was very much focused on what Europe needs to do to be at the level of expectations. So it was a lot focused on, as I said in the beginning, what kind of instruments we need to use and how. But indeed, no, I don't think that having regular time frame for updates might be a good idea, because you might review it every 2 years, or you might keep it for 10 years and it might stay. But it depends very much on what happens around.
Very true. And so, kind of recapping here, what areas of EU global action do you want to see more of in the future? Obviously, I don't want you necessarily to comment on the current HRVP. It's always impolite in politics. But EU global action is always evolving. More delegations open now more than ever. What more would you like to see from the EU in the world?
More of everything. That's a bit of a maximalistic approach. More of everything. Because what I've seen in my 5 years, and also afterwards when I left from the outside, but still looking very closely to what happens on the EU global role, is that actually there is not one single field of action in the world where the European Union cannot do more, and where the action of the European Union is not precious. It's already doing a lot. And I wouldn't say, I'm not one of those that thinks that, you know, we're not doing enough. I think we're doing more than enough. We're doing a lot. And if you for one day had to take away all the EU global action just for 24 hours. You cannot imagine how many communities, countries, international processes would delay just for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen the added value of the European Union global action in all fields, from digital to diplomacy to security to trade to environment to everything. There's not one single field where we do not have a huge potential. So mm-hmm. I would like to see more on everything.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this requires resources, human and financial, requires political investments. So you need to have the capitals behind that. You need to have the member states fully on board and taking part of the responsibility. I truly believe in the power of teamwork as a high representative, maybe because I was a foreign minister before. I always felt very much supported and not challenged by the fact that foreign ministers and member states were active. I think it's good, because the important thing is that you act towards the same goal and in a coherent manner. But it's a value we have. It's not only one, but 27 plus one. Mm-hmm. I think we have a lot of potential. So I would like to see more of everything in every sector and in every region. There's not one single region in the world where I've not seen a huge potential for the European Union to do more everywhere.
Okay. Thank you. So I have one final question, which is, let's say this June, the current HRVP, Josep Borrell, gets the mandate again for another strategy, and he tries to find where you are to sit down to grab coffee and ask for your recommendation, much like you had with former HRVP Solana. What do
and
you
that
say
was,
to
and
him?
That was indeed over coffee with Solana.
I had no mention of anything else. What would you say to Borrell?
I would say, pay attention to the method and the process first. In my experience, it has been the most precious thing. How to set up the right framework for involvement and participation. That, in my experience, that has been the most valid instrument to not only get a good result, but also get people having a sense of ownership of the results, even more than the contents. I will tell you, probably I spent more time on process than on content, because the content didn't need too much time from my side, because it was already good. Sometimes if you get the process right, the outcome is naturally close to good, let's put it this way. Mm-hmm. And I would tell him, pay a lot of attention to the way in which you involve member states, not only governments, but with an what we say in jargon, all of government approach and all society approach. Talk to students, talk to NGOs, talk to journalists, talk to talk to others around the world. That is the other thing that for me was extremely precious, not only when we drafted the global strategy, but also afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
To ask our partners around the world, even those that don't particularly like the European Union, what was their opinion on the role of the Union in the world?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that getting that view helps you seeing yourself through the mirror of others. And sometimes you get interesting ideas. But mm-hmm. I would tell him, spend a lot of time in defining a good inclusive process, involve member states, develop ownership, and listen to opinions of others also around the world, far away. Because sometimes they have a clearer view of what our responsibilities and role and potential is than ourselves. Sometimes in Europe, we tend to be focused on our limits and our problems, which is normal. And from the outside, sometimes you see the potential more. And sometimes you need to get that to get some inspiration of the next step.
Mm. I think of the process as well as a lesson that we could all learn in our projects in the future,
yes,
definitely.
Indeed.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Federica Mogherini, for joining us today. This is a very interesting insight into the EU's global strategy, and I'm sure all of our listeners do agree.
Thank you very much to you. It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And to our listeners, make sure to join us next week as well. And do follow Federica Mogherini's role as rector. You've been very active. That's been something that we students have been very excited to see. And I'm sure that others are also going to be excited to see, well, for one thing, the next document, as you say, that you're submitting to the Secretary General of the UN on migration, and all the remaining events that are to come.
Indeed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And have a good rest of the day.